Hello, everybody, and welcome to the American Shoreline Podcast. This is Peter Rabella, the co-host of the show.
And this is Tyler Buckingham, the other co-host.
Tyler, it's been widely reported this year, and perhaps a little bit last year, about concerning deaths of whales found on the Atlantic shoreline on the east coast of the United States. And according to the New York Times article, recent article at the end of February, there have been 23 dead whales washed up on the east coast since December. What we've noticed, Tyler, on Coastal News Today and following this issue and sharing the stories with our readers is there seems to be some assertion being made that the mortality of these whales is somehow directly associated with the development of wind power on the east coast of the United States. And you and I have shared a concern about that assertion, I think, and are not at all convinced that that's a legitimate assessment of the situation. And we wanted to put together a show, Tyler, that would help our readers and listeners understand this issue a little bit better. And I'm really glad we're going to get a chance to do a show on this subject today.
Me too. And we have had the great fortune of having a conversation with Rodney Cluck, Peter, you'll remember.
Yes.
Who is the science, I want to say he's the science director. Anyway, he works in the science side of BOEM. And let me tell you, talking to Rodney, we got the distinct impression that BOEM takes its science very seriously in the decision-making process of all that it does, which is more than offshore wind. And so when I began to see social media posts, I believe, saw a clip of Tucker Carlson from Fox News talking about stranded whales. I was suspicious, and I did investigate some of these media stories, and they were a bit shallow on the facts.
Yeah.
And shallow on the fact that we know, listeners of this podcast know, that the federal government, BOEM, NOAA, other federal agencies, invest a great deal of expertise and energy into understanding our marine ecosystems, marine mammals, and the impacts of offshore wind. And it just wasn't making sense that this information was coming out without stitching all these things together that we know are happening.
Right.
So I reached out to Rodney, and he put me in touch with the right people over there at BOEM. And we've got a great guest today to walk through exactly what is going on. And we're going to explore it all. We're going to ask the questions that are on all of our minds and try to understand exactly what's going on behind the scenes over there at BOEM to understand these whale mortality events and what's going on with offshore wind.
I'm so glad that you did reach out, Tyler, and I'm so glad that we were able to put this show together. And for many of our listeners out there, we're going to be talking about BOEM, which is the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, a key federal agency that is involved in all the offshore energy development on the in U.S. coastal waters, including the oil and gas leasing of the Gulf of Mexico, wind power leases, or any other resource extraction activities on the federally owned submerged land surrounding the United States. It's a key agency. And joining us today on the American Shoreline Podcast is going to be Jill Lewandowski. Jill is the Director of Environmental Assessment and the Center for Marine Acoustics at BOEM. And she has had a front row seat and a participation in the evaluation of offshore wind proposals and what those proposals might mean environmentally. So, Tyler, we've got the expert on the line to help our listeners better understand the implications of wind, the actions of BOEM and other federal agency actors, and the issue of whale risk associated with wind power. So I'm just thinking this is going to be a great and important show, and I really appreciate you putting it together, Tyler.
Well, I feel the same. This is like made for a podcast, this topic, because, you know, when you're watching a quick 2-minute news hit on Fox News, it's not about delivering the facts. That's entertainment.
Yeah.
But right here today, Peter, after we get done with the word from our sponsors, we're going to get into the real nitty-gritty details of what's going on here with Dr. Jill Lewandowski. I'm really looking forward to it. But first, let's pay the bills with a word from our sponsors.
Support for the American Shoreline Podcast Network and Coastal News Today comes from Geodynamics, an NV5 company. Geodynamics' team of specialists provide accurate surveys of complex coastal environments around the world using the latest technology in marine geology, coastal science, and remote sensing. With customized vessels and sensor configurations, Geodynamics delivers meticulous data products to answer their clients' toughest questions. Visit nv5geospatial.com or geodynamicsgroup.com to learn more about Geodynamics and their solutions that improve lives. And from the Coastal Zone Foundation. The Certified Coastal Practitioner Program from the Coastal Zone Foundation offers courses covering 11 different subject areas, including coastal engineering, ecology, geology, project management, and more. The CCP program emphasizes a multidisciplinary approach to coastal zone management, setting you apart from the competition and demonstrating your commitment to best practices and a code of ethics in your field. With modules available online or as live short courses, the CCP program is accessible to coastal professionals at all stages of their careers. Learn more at coastalzonefoundation.org. And don't forget, subscribe to the CNT Daily Blast newsletter for the latest news and updates from around the American shoreline. Want to support our work? Learn more about sponsorship packages at coastalnewstoday.com/advertising.
Dr. Lewandowski, thank you very much for joining us on the American Shoreline podcast. We could not be more privileged to have you on the show.
Well, thanks so much for the invitation. I'm looking forward to being able to share information with your listeners.
Well, I want to start out with just a little bit about you. Your title is the Director of Environmental Assessment and the Center for Marine Acoustics at BOEM. For many of our listeners who won't be familiar with BOEM, introduce us to the agency and your position at BOEM.
Sure. So BOEM is part of the Department of Interior. We are in charge of federal water, so generally, you know, greater than 3 nautical miles offshore, when it comes to managing development of what we call the Outer Continental Shelf, which is the distance 3 nautical miles out to 200 nautical miles. And we manage that for energy and minerals. So oil and gas, offshore wind, which is the topic of today's discussion. We also have a marine minerals program that looks at sand for beach renourishment and coastal wetlands build up. And then we also have an emerging directive to develop a carbon sequestration program. So that's BOEM. Now, BOEM does do a lot as far as facilitating those types of activities on the Outer Continental Shelf. But part of our mission and our vision is to do so in a responsible, environmentally responsible way, very conscientious planning, stakeholder engagement, heavily focused in on the science and, of course, the law, what is required by the law in that intersection between science and policy. Now, my role is I have kind of two hats, but they're related. The first one is what we call environmental assessment. So that is where you take all the science and the policy and you connect it and you produce risk assessments, evaluations of what you think the risk will be. And that might be under the National Environmental Policy Act. It could be under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, Endangered Species Act. But we deal with all kinds of issues, all kinds of intersections with these activities. So it might be related to environmental justice. It could be related to our tribal engagement. It might be our National Historic Preservation Act and the Section 106 process. It could be clean air, clean water. So there's a lot of different potential impacts that we look at and we evaluate. So that's my environmental assessment hat. And then under the Center for Marine Acoustics, we created this center. It's our first center of expertise, and we created it back in December of 2020 because we have been dealing with noise issues and impacts of noise on marine life for decades. And we wanted to strengthen our expertise. We wanted to make sure we were evaluating carefully what needs to be evaluated. So we built this center and we've staffed it up. And I direct that center as well. And my background does have a lot of acoustics and marine mammal work in it. So it kind of fits nicely into those two hats.
So we got the right person.
We did, Tyler, is
what you're saying. And yeah. I would like to, if it's okay, Jill, I would like to just spend a little bit more time on your expertise, because sure. You say you have what did you study on your way to running the Center for Marine Acoustics at BOEM?
Sure. So I have a PhD in environmental science and policy. So basically, I made a decision a while back in my schoolwork to focus in on that science and policy intersect. I have a master's in that as well and an undergraduate degree in biology. I spent probably close to about 15 years focused in on marine mammal issues. And of course, that's where noise concerns first intersected, was with marine mammals. And folks may remember back decades ago with some of the strandings of beaked whales that happened in the Bahamas related to certain Navy sonars. So I became involved in this, you know, back in the early 2000s and have, you know, engaged again and again, not just with marine mammals and noise, but we also do look at fish, effects of, you know, commercial fisheries, invertebrates, turtles. So the issue has expanded quite rapidly over the years, even becoming a subject a few years ago of United Nations sort of annual topic and that we looked at under the Law of the Sea. So there's a lot going on there, which is why we developed the center as well. So I would say right now it's over 20 years in acoustics and marine mammals and in dealing with those issues from both a technical perspective, as well as, you know, that intersection with the various statutes and involved, like the Marine Mammal Protection Act and Endangered Species Act.
Cool. And could you, you know, you I know that the ocean today is a noisier place than it was 200 years ago. We've talked about it before on the show, and you know, it makes totally intuitive sense. I mean, we just got more boats out there; they're running on big engines, and they're going to create more noise. So there's that component, and then we have this acoustic mapping world, and there's that noise, but. What could you give us the state of play of what ocean acoustics is? Like what's the whole pie look like?
Ocean acoustics is a field that is, like I said, growing. So for some people, they're specializing in just how do you measure sounds in the environment and not just sounds that are produced by human activities like shipping, even vessels operated for recreational purposes or fishing or sonars or looking for energy. They are just specialized in how do you measure that. So very much a physics side of the issue that many people devote their careers to. There's the biology side, which is trying to understand how do the various animals hear. It's very difficult to do like a hearing test on a large whale, although it's being attempted. We certainly have had them done across the field on smaller marine mammals and certainly seals and sea lions as well. So it's trying to understand not just from a biology perspective, not just what can the animals hear, but also what are other ways that sound may impact animals. Like we are currently investigating something associated with noise, which is particle motion or substrate vibration. How does that affect invertebrates or fish? Trying to look at those particular aspects. So you have a heavy physics component, you have the biology component, and then you have the legal component. So there are a lot of regulators across, you know, this world that are addressing noise issues, and we all try to learn from each other and, you know, look at best practices and see if another country has developed something that would be beneficial for us, where we are often exploring that. So it's a very international issue as well.
That sounds perfectly appropriate and reflects what Tyler and I's understanding is about the Environmental Assessment Division at BOEM and other federal agencies like NOAA that take very seriously the development of offshore energy resources and the implications for the environment. As we said in the opening of the show, there's been a recent spat of whale deaths in on the Atlantic coast in regions that are being discussed for potential wind development. Let's if we can, turn our attention to BOEM's role in wind power development as a particular sector of energy development offshore. Could you refresh the listeners out there's understanding of BOEM's role in wind power development? And if you can, give us a little sense of what's on the screen in terms of wind power development projects focusing on the East Coast, if you could.
We have administration goal, a priority of, 30 gigawatts by 2030. And so we've been working toward that. So BOEM's role, though, specifically is to work with various stakeholders to identify potential areas for leases, call them wind energy areas. And they often start bigger and then they get kind of, whittled down as you go through the process and you talk with different stakeholders and you figure out where there are conflicts, what should be taken off the table. You look at where the wind resources are the highest, because it does have to be, for it to be developed, it does have to be able to have the potential for producing a profit. So you try to put those all together and you come then to a specific area that you will offer for leasing. And so BOEM will run the lease sales. They'll evaluate all of that. Also from a fair market value, is because the Outer Continental Shelf is public land, essentially. So we want to make sure that the American people are getting a good, rate of return for leasing any of these lands. While we go through the leasing too, we will look at environmental stipulations to leases. You know, that's the first sort of cut at what will be required from an environmental perspective. And then once you have a lease issued, even if you have a lease, it's not a promise you can actually develop your lease. It's basically saying, okay, yes, we have agreed that we've set aside this area, but there's other plans that have to be submitted and evaluated. One is a site assessment plan, and another one would be a construction and operation plan. And those are all things that BOEM, evaluates. A site assessment, which is a little bit of the subject of what led us here today, is where a company is going to want to survey an area to find out, okay, where might be the best place for turbines? Are there unexploited ordinances in the area or other sort of shallow hazards that could be a safety issue? And so it's a way for them to really map the surface of their lease area, the surface of the substrate, as well as understand a little bit into the substrate what might be under there to help them plan their project. And so that's what's happening when we hear these surveys out there right now for wind. The next phase is the construction and operation plan. And that's where they have to give us a detailed plan on how they would construct, operate, and even a preliminary plan on how they would decommission, because these are about these projects last about 30 years. And it's in that phase as well as a site assessment that we're going to be doing, evaluations in all the statutes that touch it. And, at last count, that can be anywhere from like 11 to 15 different things. So we will go through all of those evaluations, consultations with stakeholders. Many of those evaluations have public comment periods. We'll look at the science. You mentioned Dr. Rodney Kluck. He's my counterpart. So he does the environmental science side of the house. And his group and my group work hand in hand, as well as with our folks who are actually processing these plans in our Office of Renewable Energy Programs. And we're going to pull together, you know, okay, here are the impacts we think could potentially happen. What's available science is there? What does it tell us? How certain is it? You know, some things have been better studied and have more consistent answers, and other things haven't been necessarily fully studied yet. And so we're trying to understand that. Not only what is available from a scientific standpoint, but while we're doing that, if we come across something where we're like, you know, we need more information here, we feed that back into our environmental studies program, which is part of our statute. We are required to have this program. We love it. We take it very seriously. And so those bits of uncertainty, we will feed back into that program and try to, you know, fund some studies to help us reduce that uncertainty.
Well, I gotta say, you know, I think in so many of our listeners, Tyler, are engaged in say shoreline management activities around the American shoreline, beach renourishment, and are familiar with the complexity of federal environmental review procedures, and not to mention state. And in the profession, in our coastal professional community, I think people have a fairly clear understanding of the depth and complexity and level of effort required to undertake all kinds of projects in the marine environment, whether it's a beach renourishment project or a construction of major port facilities or any number of infrastructure style activities on the American shoreline. It's a big deal. And that's not different for wind power, Jill, is what I'm getting from you, is there is a serious level of effort. There isn't a predisposition to execute wind power. There is a step-by-step process. And what I want to ask about here is what the science is suggesting to you so far with respect to the development activities for wind power and what that might mean or what risks that might pose to marine mammals generally, whales in particular. Why is it important to understand the issues? What's the potential concern?
Sure. So I do sort of want to preface what I'll kind of get into next about your question. But I want to preface it by saying, first and foremost, the science is science, and it's a key and critical role in this. But I also understand the unique kind of nature that marine mammals hold for many people. So I get why people are concerned. You know, it's upsetting to see marine mammals wash ashore. Not just from a perspective of, you know, their charismatic megafauna. You have concerns about what might be happening out there in the oceans that's leading to this. And even, you know, I would say more importantly, for many of our tribes along the coast, these are very revered animals. And and for some tribes, they're actually ancestors. So that's like a family member, you know, coming ashore. So it is, I understand why people are very, very concerned. And I hold that concern. You know, I am at heart, you know, an environmentalist. You know, I spent my career and my energy, you know, developing that further so that I can understand the best ways to, you know, move forward on things that are important to our nation, but doing so while we can protect the environment. So totally get it. When it comes to impacts from offshore wind on marine mammals, you know, basically we have done a number, an uncountable number, actually probably right now, of evaluations on that. And, you know, I want to start first by addressing the site assessment surveys and what is currently being considered by some as resulting in these strandings. These site assessment surveys, which are the surveys I mentioned that are about just looking at the seafloor, looking a little bit below the seafloor to look for hazards and help plan for siting of turbines, they're basically done using sound. And so they're sound, though, from what we would call high resolution geophysical sources. You know, sparkers, boomers, chirpers, they've got lots of names to them. They are not air guns. The offshore wind industry does not use air guns. Air guns are another thing that people may be familiar with. And when they're put into large arrays, they will penetrate even kilometers down into the seabed. And that's used when you're trying to find hydrocarbon resources like oil and gas. So these are very, very different resources that are being used. Enough that we had with our partners, NOAA and other agencies, you know, we had said to ourselves years ago that, all right, we've looked at this. We're not concerned about these particular high resolution sources having an impact. But we said to ourselves, you know, that's our professional opinion based on some information out there, but let's just make sure we're right. And so what we did is we let some studies or funded some studies to look at laboratory measurements of these sources, field measurements, and then we went forward with some modeling on them. And then based off of that, we worked with other federal partners in the U.S. Geological Survey, as well as independent scientists, and we put out a peer-reviewed publication that just happened to come out last year in 2002 in the Journal of Marine Science and Engineering, where we evaluated these sources based off that previous research that had been done.
Jill, I'm sorry. I just want to correct. Are you saying 2022 or 2002 the study was released?
Oh, I'm sorry. 2022. Thank you for correcting me. So, yes, so it's relatively new, but what the paper did in the study is it basically looked at sort of the physics side of this, and basically we looked at various characteristics of these resources, and to understand of, okay, which could they be a concern, or are they not a concern such that we would want to basically establish that and focus more of our time on other things? So one thing I would say on these sources is, you know, not every sound is created alike. So you'll hear sometimes these called sonars, and that's not necessarily incorrect depending on which source you're talking about. But not every sound is created alike. Not every sonar is created alike. They can be operating at different frequencies or pitch. They can be operating at different intensities or amplitude. And so this, when we did this paper based off the study, we looked at the characteristics of these specific sources used for offshore wind. And some of them, first of all, operate above the frequency of marine mammal hearing. And so if they can't hear it, that's your first sort of tier to say, okay, we're not going to worry about those sources that operate above those frequencies. And we take that, the hearing is, NOAA establishes that through acoustic threshold. So we understand what the threshold is. And so we say to ourselves, okay, these sources, they can't hear even, we shouldn't worry about it. The next thing is you say, okay, maybe they can hear it. How loud is it? You know that from, I always think of that ambulance, you know, or the fire truck. So from a distance away, it's not so loud, but when it comes right up at you at the intersection, it's very loud. So that's sort of a change in amplitude. It's approaching you, you know, those sorts of things can, you know, you can have a different reaction depending on where that noise is in relation to you and how loud it is. And so we looked at that, and for the most part, these sources are not that loud. But you also look at sort of the beam width. Some folks may have an impression that these sources just go out and they span, you know, the whole seafloor for kilometers. And that's not the case. Most of them are directed downward in a very narrow beam, like in some cases, even like a 10 meter size beam. And they're moving along at a very slow pace. So it's not that they're insonifying the water column out to great distances, where louder, you know, more higher amplitude sources that are created a little differently may do that, not these sources. And so the outcome of the paper is, and we looked at some other things as well, but the outcome of the paper is that most of these sources would be considered de minimis, meaning don't even require mitigation, don't require approvals from the government, and in a select few of them, mainly some of the sparkers, you could operate them with some mitigation that we identified and not worry about impacts. And so that's where we are as a federal government. And so we were very surprised when there started to be a link between, these whale strandings and these surveys from offshore wind.
Well, and I do want to say, like, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, if you're going to take in some media on the subject of whale strandings and if there's any potential sonic implications, it should sound like this, like the conversation we're having. It should have to do with, high resolution sources. And there should be a distinction between air guns and those different types of sources and insonifying. I don't think that Tucker Carlson has ever encountered the word insonifying. I certainly hadn't until this moment. So this is like some technical stuff, and there's a lot of variation. And I want to point that out. It's not as simple as just, we use sound to map, and we're doing quite a bit of that. It's right. A more complicated thing. And I'm just curious, we're talking about whales. We're talking about marine mammals, actually. So like a spectrum of different species. How do you, I know you work with some incredible colleagues and scientists, but could you go into a little bit of detail? Like, how do you know what a whale can hear? I'm just curious. Yeah.
There are actual hearing tests. Well, let me phrase that. So, marine mammals, you have your large whales, that have the baleen, your humpback whales, your right whales, sei whales. You have sperm whales that are also large, but they have a different kind of teeth. You've got dolphins and porpoises and, of course, seals and sea lions, manatees and walrus and sea otters. So there's a whole host of things. The smaller ones, and particularly the ones that tend to be found in zoos and aquariums, we've been able to do, the larger scientific community, but some of it funded by BOEM, we've been able to do hearing tests on them. You can't quite do that on a large whale, attempted.
Before we move on, I think this is interesting. So this is an example of where an aquarium or some sort of enclosure could really be beneficial, Peter. I tend to not like the idea of marine mammals in aquaria, but I have to say it is really important to be able to understand, for science, like specifically what these creatures are able to sense.
Yes.
And it's interesting. So you got some marine mammals, they're in an enclosure. And so I guess you would play different sounds at them and see how they react to it.
Yeah. So you're never trying to play any sound that is going to be potentially damaging to the ears, right? So you're playing sounds that are always going to be, below that. And in these cases, the animals are trained, right, to respond to a sound, just like we go into, the hearing booth and you raise your right arm if you hear it, you raise it on your left arm if you hear it on your left side. They don't quite do that, right? But they're trained to...
The flipper, really.
They could do a flipper, I suppose. I think some of the sea lions, they actually do that, but... So they'll be stationed, they're trained to station at one point in the enclosure. And if they hear a sound, they're trained to leave that and go touch another sort of station or a pole with something at the end of it to indicate they heard a sound. And, the experiments will go where they'll not play sounds. And then play sounds, right? So they're, because these animals are smart and they're going to start predicting if you have a pattern. And so there are a field of people in here. And we just brought on somebody into the Center of Marine Acoustics who has done her PhD work just on marine mammal hearing. And that's how you start to get a picture of it. We have also from animals who have, stranded and died over the years. There are people in the field who are experts in hearing. And so they may take the ears. These animals are often necropsied, right? So they may take the ears and study the ears, compare it to mammalian hearing. I mean, these are mammals. So it's reasonable to assume that some of what they have operates in the same way as us. And so you put all this picture together to get an idea of what these animals hear. And NOAA has done that. And they did that through some independent review with outside experts. And they basically have binned them into different hearing groups based off the frequencies of which we think they can hear at.
Yeah. So let's see if I'm following along so far. Thank you so much for this explanation. Point number one, not all noise sources or sonar or survey equipment is equal. There are very, very intensive differences between what the United States Navy might be doing in sonar detection, long-range sonar, that kind of thing. Even within surveying, there are a variety of acoustic equipment and approaches that are utilized. There are significant arrays of things done for oil and gas that are not necessary in the wind power industry, where you're not trying to read a strata that's 3 kilometers under the seafloor, which means you have to produce enough acoustic energy to penetrate it 3, 4, 5 meters, kilometers deep. What we're talking about is a lighter kind of surveying. What I'm curious about is it's not all the same, and this tends to be lighter. I would like to know about the duration. So when someone is surveying a site, an offshore lease area that has been put up for, made available by BOEM for potential wind development, who typically is operating the equipment? And how does the surveying time, is it a matter of a couple of days? Is it 10 weeks? Is it 6 months? Are the sound sources being done 24 hours a day? Give us a sense of in the site assessment surveying universe, kind of a magnitude or duration of the experience and who is doing the work.
Great. So, yeah, so it is either the companies doing the work, actually running these surveys, or somebody that they contract out to.
Mm-hmm. So private sector,
private sector. And I would point out too, that these kinds of surveys that help map the ocean floor, I mean, they've been going on for decades in the Atlantic. They're not new. They're done by a variety of different sectors. So it's not that, you know, offshore wind has brought some sort of new sound source into the Atlantic. It's something that's been happening there fairly regularly. For these actual surveys, you know, it depends. It may run a few days. It may run, 2-3 weeks. But the source is not on all the time. It is mostly going to be obviously operated during the daytime. Instead of nighttime, it's going to be operated. They may have a certain kind of transect lines that they want to go by, and they may turn off as they move into a new transect line. And the sources, for the most part, are not fully continuous. There are some sources that are continuous. Like if you were to hear a vessel go by, that's continuous noise. It's constantly going. There's no like break. As opposed to like somebody, you know, clapping, you know, there's breaks in between the noise, you know, that allow for a little more communication as well. And so a lot of these sources do have very short sort of pulse lengths, meaning they're milliseconds or in the order of a few seconds, and then there's space in between before the next pulse comes. So, yeah, so there we consider them to be very kind of small surveys in scope, obviously, and smaller intensity of sources, smaller timeframes than other things.
A matter of a couple of weeks, they're episodically done. And I want to talk about one of the great fallacies of logical fallacies that we often fall into, and the difference between correlation and causation. And I'm going to just use an example. There have been 23 whales that have washed up on the, apparently from the, according to the New York Times, on the Atlantic shoreline since December. This has all gone on during the NBA season, and we could correlate. We could find out whether the New York Knicks are winning basketball games on the day that the animals are found, and we could postulate that every time the Knicks lose a game, that there seems to be a whale death. I mean, there's clearly, if you could map it out, there's a there's sort of a relationship between the whale's body showing up on the shore and what the New York Knicks are doing. And everybody in their right mind would say that, well, it's absolutely absurd that there would be any connection between what the Knicks are doing in the NBA and what's going on with the whales in the ocean. And the fact that offshore wind seismic is occurring at a time when these whales these whale fatalities have occurred have allowed a large number of people to assert a causal relationship between the activities and the fatalities of these animals. And so here's my question. This is there any basis to connect wind power development, seismic site assessment, any of the associated activities that are occurring in the water? Is there any reason to believe that those activities are directly or indirectly causing the death of marine mammals and whales in particular? What do you guys think?
No, there is nothing to support that. And we actually recently, too, we have through the National Academy of Science, we have a standing committee that we meet with periodically, and they kind of review work that we've done. And we just had this actually March 20th, I believe, and folks can go online and you know, see recordings from that. But those are outside experts that were brought in, and we talked about this work we had done in the paper and what our findings were. And those experts also supported the stance that what's happening with the whales right now is nothing to do with the offshore wind industry. We are also seeing that come out of the U.S. Marine Mammal Commission. They are government, but they're an independent agency that has oversight on all marine mammal issues across the government. They also came out with a statement that it is not related to offshore wind. And NOAA, of course, has also come out with a statement along that lines. I've seen the National Resource Defense Council come out with a statement along the lines. So I would say that within the community that really investigates these issues related to acoustics and impacts, people are scratching their heads as to how this connection was made. And of course, I recognize, like I said earlier, you know, these are important species for many people, and there's a lot of concern, and I share that concern. But it is not from offshore wind.
Well, and I appreciate the clarity there, because I think, you know, and your colleagues know better than any entertainer out there who's trying to get clicks and listens. And that's really what I just want to take a pause here and comment on, which is that we live in a social media culture, and conspiracy theory and misinformation are prevalent in our modern world. It's just part of American life, Peter, on the American shoreline, even in the beautiful communities that dot our wonderful country all around the edge. Indeed. There is misinformation. It is there. It's not strictly limited to offshore wind, of course, but offshore wind is not immune to the fact that people throw out these kind of storylines that exist and ignore the science. And the science, I will acknowledge, the other social media isn't exactly great at communicating complex things either, because it's very fast and it's designed to get your engagement. So I think that part of the problem here is that culturally, we weren't really set up to be duped. And that's why we're doing the show, is to set the record straight. So I do want to ask you, Jill, I mean, 20-something whale strandings seems like a lot to me. Does this, when you hear about this, as I'm sure you do, what actions are taken by BOEM when whales are stranded? And, how are these matters investigated for real? Like, what is actually going on now, today, to understand what's happening?
So I will say NOAA is the agency that has the purview over, handling the stranded animals. So they have an entire network set up across the United States. They have, regulations in place, procedures. And so they are the ones that'll manage what happens when these animals come ashore or strand. They have established, what they call unusual mortality events. So there is a recognition, or widespread recognition, that there are more whales, humpback whales, right whales, that are, you know, showing up stranded and dying or having some serious injuries to them in more recent years. So the UMEs, the unusual mortality events, started back in, I think, 2016 for humpback whales. Oops, sorry, 2017 for right whales. And there are a lot of whales. I mean, you hear about what's happened in the most recent time, but if you look over the course of those years, it's a lot. But of the whales that they have looked at, 40% of them show signs of vessel strikes or entanglement in certain types of fishing gear, particularly crab and lobster, because that tends to have longer lines. And so we're looking at an ocean environment that's changing in climate. We're looking at an ocean that's industrialized. There's shipping. If you look at the amount of shipping that happens along the Northeast coast, it's quite a lot. You know, and some of these whales tend to be closer, you know, into shore, like the right whales. Some of them may be moving in because their food sources are moving closer to shore as the climate's changing and they're following them. So, yes, I am concerned about, you know, what is happening with these with the whales. And it's not to say it's only NOAA that's responsible for figuring this out. We are actually working with them right now and finalizing a North Atlantic right whale and offshore wind strategy. And that strategy is fully aimed at, you know, promoting offshore wind, but promoting the recovery of right whales. So not just protecting them, but helping them to recover. It's got a huge component of research in there and monitoring what we're going to do when the projects start constructing, because right now it's set for two small demonstration projects of about 8 turbines total. None of these projects have started construction yet. They're all sort of in that site assessment or leasing phase. So we're taking it very, very seriously. All the authorizations that NOAA has issued for site assessments under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, for example, have only been for allowing a limited amount of harassment. So when people hear the word take, they're thinking, oh, you're killing them. No, a take can be, you change their behavior a little bit because they got distracted, disrupted by something you're doing. That's the extent of the type of, you know, take this harassment that they're allowing a limited amount. And this right whale strategy is meant to take that down as close to zero as possible.
Well, I think that's important. The strategy, the joint NOAA-BOEM strategy on assessment of right whale risks in offshore wind power development was released, I believe, in October of last year, Jill. Still under development. Is there a chance for the public to still review that document, participate, and evaluate the comment? Is that still open on that strategy?
The comment period has closed. So that was the draft that we put out there. And right now we're going through it and we're finalizing it, but it's going to be a living document. It is, there's no way that we can just be, you know, one and done and we know exactly what we need to do for the next 30 years. There will be an implementation group that we're going to have it be multi-stakeholder that's going to adapt that as new information becomes available. The science starts turning over more data, the monitoring does. For example, we're going to put a whole passive acoustic monitoring system. We're planning for that across all the leases and in between in the North Atlantic so that we have the ability. The goal of this would be to say, do the presence of turbines affect where the whales are spending their time?
Mm-hmm. Do we know? I mean, right now, I'm not sure I'm right about this. So let me ask a question. We all are, I think, generally aware of the Vineyard Wind offshore wind power facility, which, if my recollection serves, is 30 turbines. How many turbines are currently offshore wind turbines are currently in operation off of the Atlantic coast of the United States?
Right now, I believe the number is like 8, because there's just the two demonstration projects. Vineyard Wind has not started construction, although there may be some construction of cable, like cable laying, but no construction of turbines yet. And there's two approved projects. There's Vineyard Wind and South Fork.
And, you know, Tyler, I really appreciated your point about the importance of accurately understanding the problem. And for the listeners out there, and if you're reading these stories in the paper that are throwing out these wild assertions about the connection between offshore wind development and whale mortality, it's not just politics and it's not just entertainment and it's not without consequence. Accurately understanding and diagnosing appropriate what is actually occurring in these populations of marine mammals is critical to doing anything effective. And when people deflect the analysis of those and the understanding of those mortality events down a rabbit trail of BS, we are losing opportunity to understand and respond to real problems. This misinformation has real consequences in the world. And I don't know, Jill, it's frustrating to me, and I can't tell you that how much I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you on this show to kind of address that, because it's not silly. This isn't just silly fun and politics. This is real stuff with real implications, and we got to get it right. And there's no place for this kind of misinformation out there.
Yeah, and I would say too, when something like this happens, it, you know, we not only get a lot of, you know, media requests, right? We have a lot of stakeholders contact us. We have a lot of requests under the Freedom of Information Act. And so it means we spend a lot of time, you know, focused on doing those things instead of focusing on where we think there's a potential for impacts and putting our time there. So it does have a cascading effect.
Well, keep doing it right. We know that you do, you and your team, the folks at NOAA and others. And even in the nonprofit advocacy, the community, the people who look out for these whale populations, there are a lot of people focused on ensuring that our offshore resource development activities are as sensitively developed and undertaken. And I trust it. I trust you, and I trust your agency, and I trust your team. And I think the American public has every right to as well. So we sure appreciate the chance to look through it, and we'll give you final thoughts, Jill.
Well, thank you. Thanks again for the opportunity to sort of provide our perspective and talk a bit about our work, and hopefully give some of your listeners, hopefully a lot of your listeners, more confidence in the process. I would say if anybody wants to look for more information, please just go to boehm.gov, boehm.gov. We have information up there on acoustics. You can go to NOAA.gov, NOAA.gov, and learn more about these strandings and about these unusual mortality events. So, yeah, just encourage folks when they see something they're worried about, you know, to spend a little more time investigating it and looking for those answers. And I, again, just appreciate the opportunity to share our information today. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Dr. Jill Lewandowski. She is the Director of Environmental Assessment and the Center for Marine Acoustics at the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Department of the U.S. Department of the Interior. Jill, we really appreciate the time. We look forward to updates from the agency, and we look forward to seeing the unfolding of a comprehensive strategy on offshore wind in America. We're supporters. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.